you want to repeat the question? Do you want to repeat the question, though?
I'll repeat the question so everyone can hear it. The gentleman asked who our best guesses are for who the presidential nominees or candidates will be in 2024. And I'll leave it to my panel. Scott McKay, go ahead.
Boy, I don't have a clue. I really, really don't. I mean, I think demographics are on the side of the Democrats in this country. If Republicans don't change some of their stances toward our newly arrived citizens. On the other hand, you know, people are fed up with big government, and they tend to react against the administration that's in there. So I have no clue what that's going to look like in 2024 or the personalities involved. Maybe they'll be younger than 74.
Anyone else want to weigh in?
If we go back to 2008, who would have said Donald Trump?
That's all I have to say.
I'll throw some names out there, establishment candidates. So we were just talking about, I think Paul Ryan, current Speaker of the House, is still always going to be perennial considered for running for president. And you said, Brandon said, Nikki Haley, who's a very impressive female governor of South Carolina, Republican. On the Democratic side, Kirsten Gillibrand, I think, if for some reason Hillary Clinton were to lose, I think she goes up, and she's a senator from New York State. And I also think Kamala Harris in California, African-American Attorney General. She's a star in the making who apparently doesn't like to campaign and doesn't like to fundraise. So if she can still win the Senate seat in 2016 in California, that maybe she'll get to the Senate and forge her way. But I think she is someone we should be paying attention to.
Any other questions? Sir.
Yes. One issue about this Democratic platform has been essentially Bernie Sanders has defined the platform, if it's over or not. So shouldn't he be the nominee if the platform, if we had a parliamentary system, that's what we would be voting for. And one other part to it, and he's brought up climate change being a threat to a habitat that exists for us to live in. And there is no follow-up questions, and there's no discussions about that. What does that say about our political race?
The question is about Bernie Sanders and his impact on the race, whether he should be the nominee, given that he has kind of dictated a lot of the discussion. And also in terms of our questioner feels that he's gone a little too unquestioned on the impact of climate change.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
So who wants to take
an existential.
Well, I do think that the platforms mean a lot less. It's kind of a wonk thing in each party. And I think if Clinton was smart, he'd give Sanders just about whatever he wants in the platform in exchange for his trying to help her out in November. I think that would be a pretty good deal for her, thankfully. I don't expect any of the major planks in the Democratic platform, particularly on social issues, to change very much. I would think that it's going to be support legal abortion, gay marriage, a lot of the things that have really distinguished the Republicans from the Democrats in recent years and made the Democrats more of an urban, educated, elite party and made the Republicans more of a rural party in a lot of the states. And basically, folks who were more evangelical, who identify closer with religion. I call the Republicans the party of the plutocrats and the preachers. And I think, unfortunately, the preachers are mad because over the years, these people said, we're going to stop gay marriage, stop abortion. They elected these folks. And guess what? It hasn't happened. And I think that's a serious problem for the real base of the Republican Party. So we're going to have to on climate change. You know, at some point, there's going to have to be a rational discussion on that between guys who bring snowballs into the, you know, the Senate and watch them melt. And between people who are totally full of doom and gloom that the world is going to end in some kind of environmental rapture within 5 years. So I really wish we could turn down some of the volume on that issue and get to the specifics and the basics.
Brandon, Wendy, do you guys want to weigh in on that?
I'd like to turn up the volume on fighting ISIS. You know, after waking up to that horrible news this morning, you know, we need to be concerned about protecting our home. I mean, it's a huge issue right now. As far as platform issues, you know, look, as Rhode Island Republicans, I've had this conversation with you guys many times. As Rhode Island Republicans, you know, we're John Chafee Republicans. I have to be careful whenever I say the first name, John Chafee Republicans. And we believe in and limited government and conservative principles, but we don't necessarily run on some of the national platform issues here in Rhode Island.
Yeah, just really quickly on climate change. I think Hillary Clinton has been forced by Bernie Sanders' campaign and the competitiveness of the campaign to downplay climate change in the upper Midwest, where she lost Michigan but then won Ohio. And when you think about a competitive race at the presidential level in the general election, you know, you can't talk about climate change the same way in the upper Midwest as you do in other parts of the country. So I think that's probably why you haven't seen as much of that engagement, at least within the Democratic Party, between Clinton and Sanders, because for Clinton, it's an area she can't really go into if she's going to defeat Bernie Sanders in key states that aren't as friendly towards the ideas of limiting carbon emissions and limiting greenhouse gases as other states. President Obama's done a tremendous amount through regulation, which makes the Republicans really go ballistic. But he has been incredibly active on climate change through regulations. And the Supreme Court one week says, no, you can't do that. The next week they say, yes, you can do that. So it's been a fragmented policy both in the courts and at the executive branch on climate change. And you're going to hope it's going to move in a more coherent direction one way, I think. Well, one way, I think.
Sanders is interesting. You know, I've known him for 40 years. And when he started, he was basically a liberal workers kind of guy, very focused on labor issues, issues of inequality. His environmental traction came later on. Now, you can't be a statewide politician in Vermont, which he's been since 1990, basically, been elected, started at Congress the same year as Jack Reed. He's been there quite a while. But in Vermont, that's like the gold standard. If you're not pro-environment, you're not going to get elected. So Sanders, over the years, has become much more of an advocate for the environment than he was as a younger politician when I knew him, even as mayor of Burlington.
Any other questions? Let's go in the back there, in the corner near, next to the bookcase. Yes.
Yeah, one of the kind of confusing things for some of us who are following the campaigns so far is I'm starting, and others I've talked to are starting to hear a lot of Republicans chortling and wringing their hands with a certain amount of glee about the idea of an open convention. And for those of us, you know, just kind of watching, listening, it's confusing in a way because you have a candidate, Donald Trump, who, whatever you may think of him, he's injected a whole lot of energy into your party, and he's driving record turnouts in many of the primaries. If some machinery goes into action at the convention and you slot in something like a Ryan or a Romney, who's not even part of this campaign, or go for a Cruz, who doesn't seem electable, or a safe choice like Kasich, are you not then left with a large number of very energized Trump supporters who have a potential to be a little bit violent?
Let me repeat the question. The question is whether Republicans, because of the energy and support that Donald Trump has brought to the race, might be making a mistake in trying to eliminate him as their nominee, and whether that could backfire for the Republican Party. Brandon Bell, what do you say?
I don't think it's going to backfire. I think people need to be more educated on the way the rules work. And Leanne Senek just wrote a piece, and it should be published in the Providence Journal any day now, our national committee woman, about what it takes to win a majority and how our delegates are elected here. And, you know, it's really important to note that to get to the 1,237, that's a majority. If Donald Trump shows up at the convention in Cleveland with 1,100, he did not get a majority. So, you know, of the 2,470 of delegates. So it's really important. This system, open convention, contested convention, I hate brokered conventions. That sounds like smoke-filled rooms, although I wouldn't mind smoking a few cigars with some of those guys and ladies. But at the end of the day, it's not a bad thing. I don't think the party is going to break up. I believe Donald Trump has done exactly what you've said. 20,000 Democrats, apparently, in Massachusetts registered as Republicans to vote for Donald Trump. And that's a huge deal. But you're not stealing it. This open convention idea.
Meaning that you're
Yeah, I mean, if you look at some of the rallies, and like I said, I don't turn the volume up, but I've seen them. If you look at some of the rallies, there probably will be some pretty upset people if that were to happen. I don't believe for a moment that our nominee is going to be anyone other than Ted Cruz, Donald Trump, or John Kasich. That's me, because I believe that consensus-wise, I don't think that now somebody who has not run, who has not gone through this primary process and the 50 debates, actually it was a lot less this year, but to go through that process and then suddenly emerge as the candidate. You might have a Kasich and Cruz ticket. I don't know. I don't have any insider knowledge on that. I just go to Vegas and make some money if I did.
You know, the one.
Go to another. Our time is short, so I'd like to get more questions in. The young lady in front.
Yeah, one question about the primary. What are the implications of turnout for the primaries?
You mean that turnout? The media is reporting that turnout.
26, and is everybody going to go and vote in the primary, and why should they?
Well, I think that certainly the Republican primary, I think because we have an open primary here, you can show up that day and affiliate and vote in the Republican primary. So if you have traditional Republicans in Rhode Island who are fearful of a Trump ticket, you'll have them come out to vote just to make sure that Trump doesn't win Rhode Island. So you could see that. Or the other way around, people energized by Trump who normally would vote on the Democratic side might vote, particularly if Hillary Clinton is already leading, to vote for Trump. So I think it will generate more activity. And we know in political science, if people vote in the primary, they vote in the general almost all the time.
One of the quick things here is when people have something to vote for, something really at stake, they turn out. If you go back to 2008, that very, very competitive race with vigorous campaigns, both on the Democratic side, you had Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama coming here. We felt like New Hampshire for about 5 days, and it was kind of fun. That was over 200,000 voters. That was a record for a Rhode Island primary. Now, in 2000, on the Republican side, the record there was driven by John McCain, who had a very strong kind of outsider maverick message, again, against George W. Bush. So I think that it'll depend by April 26th what's really at stake. Is this wrapped up for Trump? And on the other question, or Clinton, the other question, you know, if Donald Trump goes into the convention with 1,100 delegates, let me tell you, there's 50 people who want to be U.S. attorneys and 55 more who want to be ambassadors. You can swing some delegates if you're that strong.
Yes, question.
No, that gentleman. You've been waiting a long time, sir.
I'd like to know your reaction to the idea that the best way for Hillary Clinton to cement Bernie Sanders' supporters in her behalf in the election is to name him her vice presidential candidate.
The question is whether the best way to attract the support of Sanders supporters for Hillary Clinton would be for her to name him as her VP pick.
You know, Bernie Sanders is from a small, very, very deep blue state. That state's as blue as Lake Champlain on a beautiful July sunny day. Bernie Sanders doesn't get you much in that respect. I do think, however, that she's going to need him as a campaign ally to go around the country, to do the internet stuff, to really get his people out there. You know, he raised more money last month than she did.
Let's go to this gentleman here.
Well, along the same lines, I guess. What are the chances? I get it. I don't understand why they don't come out and say, okay, Bernie Sanders, 74 years old, he may not make it through 8 years. Who's the next person in line? Why don't they name those people up front, including Bernie? I don't want Bernie Sanders for a vice president. He's 74 years old.
Hang on. Okay, I've got it.
But why don't they start recruiting better people for Congress?
All right.
Who cares? Bernie versus Hillary. If you got the stupid Congress at the same thing, why aren't they working together to do that?
We've got it. Thank you. The question is whether Sanders' age could be a liability in office, because he might, and whether what would it take to have a better Congress?
Well, having studied Congress historically for long periods of history, we go through cycles in American history with really bad Congresses, multiple years in a row where very inadequate, not so sharp, not so dedicated people get elected to Congress, and there's a majority of them in both chambers. And then we go through periods where we have a heyday. So the 1980s actually had some amazing legislators on the Republican and the Democratic side in the Congress. Sort of amazing legislators and Sam Rayburn's day. And then we go through a dip. And then we go back and forth and back and forth. I think the worrisome thing here is that younger people who might think about politics are getting very much turned off by politics today. And the amount of money that you have to raise to run from now, not the party, but individual millionaires and billionaires, is daunting to a lot of people. So we are in a lull period in terms of the quality of the membership of Congress. And I'm hopeful that history will repeat itself and we come out of the lull and have better people elected in the future. But I don't know that it's unique to this period of time. We go through this. Well, we got to find them.
Okay, I see a question in the back there. Sir.
For Mr. Bell. I know you said this is the election of we the people. And that's largely not the message coming from your party, it seems like. So I know after the last presidential election, when President Obama pretty much soundly defeated Romney, the message that you guys had for months afterwards is that we need to be more inclusive of minorities, and in particular Latinos, which you guys have pretty much attacked one thing throughout. So my question is, what's the calculus, and what's your guys' strategy in the general election?
The question was whether the Republican Party has walked away from heeding the Latino voting bloc, and if so, what is the strategy?
There is the RNC has really done a tremendous amount of work in the last 4 years. There was an autopsy that was done after the 2012 election to see what went wrong. And a lot of it was data not getting into those communities, into the Latino communities, and getting more Hispanic support and persons of color. I am amazed at how much work has been done. We have the Republican Leadership Institute, RLI. They are getting out into the communities, going places where Republicans were not comfortable previously in going to. So I think that this year, for me, that question also goes to why a candidate like Marco Rubio didn't resonate more with that, you know, with the Cuban American heritage. So it's because he had quite a story. I still has it, by the way, but he's just not on the pedestal anymore. So, again, I think that there's a lot of work being done for community outreach, getting into those communities, and I'm seeing it. We go to these RNC meetings, and I'm amazed at it, and we'll see if it works for the cycle.
I think it's very difficult to impose things from the top down, particularly in a volatile year like this. The RNC, none of that has resonated with the base of the voters.
We've got some questions over here. Let's go with the young lady by the column. Yes, you.
Thank you. This election, it seems to me that both sides have come up with the opposition of both sides is really saying basically the same thing, like enough already of your antics, enough already of this stuff that we've been dealing with your inaction and your favoritism to the wealthy and the special interests and stuff like that. And yet the established parties in both cases are talking about like how to minimize that effect. For example, the Republican attempt to squash Trump's victories, and the Democrats saying, "Okay, we'll just go with Hillary," and not really, don't seem paying too much attention to Sanders. So, my question is, do you feel that that statement by the people on the edges and I don't think they're necessarily. I mean, they're presented as the edges. I have the feeling that they're not so edgy. Really, a lot of people feel the same way. Do you feel that that will have any effect at all on the parties going forward? Or is this like a one-off, like, oh my God, that was weird, but let's get on with the regular business?
The question is about how there's been a lot of populist support, for lack of a better word, for both from the right and the left, and how the establishment parties seem to be trying to avoid that sentiment, and whether that will have a lasting impact in this election cycle and beyond.
Yeah, I find this interesting. These things, as Wendy alluded to before, they seem to wax and wane. You go back to, say, 1964 on the Goldwater side, and I think some of that is still resonating with Republicans. 1972 with McGovern. Now, both of those folks got crushed. However, they both had lasting their lasting messages in both parties as to what happened. The McGovern led to the opening up of the Democratic Party prior to primary. It ended the support for Vietnam War policies. On Goldwater's side, it really is the beginning of the new populist conservative movement. Now, they were both different people, much different than this time around. Barry Goldwater and, you know, George McGovern. George McGovern was viewed as a pacifist, but if you know his record, he was a World War II bomber pilot hero. And Goldwater also was that. They were military folks. It was a different America, and they could disagree without being disagreeable. I mean, Hubert Humphrey and Goldwater used to fight all day on the floor and go out and have a beer together after. That doesn't happen in Washington anymore, and I think it's sad.
Yes.
I have two questions. First of all, many Americans grow weary of the duration of the campaign season. And what exacerbates that is the cost associated with endless campaigning. And I'd be curious to know from on the panel, what kind of support you think that there is for the concept of a national primary day, where the Republicans vote nationally for their candidate, the Democrats vote for their candidate, well, let's say in September, and then we have a cycle in November, we have an election, and we move on to the question of governing. That's question number one. Question number two for Mr. Bell. What observation do you draw from the fact that Donald Trump has, in fact, whether we like it or not, garnered the largest consistency, the largest number of votes in this season? And do you see the possibility existing of the Republican Party as a result splintering into what we, the media calls the establishment, whatever that represents, party, and then whatever the constituency is of Donald Trump representing whatever that party might be?
Okay, I think it was actually a three-part question. It's a good question. Considering the length and expense of presidential campaigns, is it realistic to think that there might be support for something like a national primary day that would truncate the process and make it shorter? And then for Brandon Bell, what conclusion does he draw from the success of Donald Trump, and will it splinter the GOP?
So part one, maybe part one and two, would be I don't believe that there'll be much support for a national primary. And one of the primary reasons for that, no pun intended, is that the candidate with the most money would win. You need to have this process. There's a reason why, you know, the regional primaries, you know, and candidates being able to go out and get that support. Otherwise, a Donald Trump type could spend $1 billion and it'll be just about getting, you know, that type of support. Part two, or part three, which was about what will resonate with Donald Trump. I think all the pundits have been wrong a million times over. We thought it was the summer of Trump. They thought it was the fall of Trump, the winter of Trump. It's now the spring. Snowing, but it was the spring. And at the end of the day, I think that it's a populist movement. As a student of political science, I could say that this is a once-in-a-lifetime type of thing. I think it's a the reality TV star who, you know, Donald Trump will always be known for that guy who was the reality TV star who came along and got this populist movement going. I don't think it's going to fracture the Republican Party, ultimately. I think it'll strengthen the party.
Just to jump in, two things. Donald Trump has not gotten the most number of votes. Actually, I believe Hillary Clinton has gotten the most number of pure votes. So Donald Trump has gotten a lot of votes and more Republican votes, but not the most number of votes cast this season. Right, the most number of Republican votes. But second, the party chair, state party chair, will not tell you that there's a lot of you know, vested interests by state party chairs and political consultants and news media organizations at the local level to make sure we keep presidential politics local. And third, for Scott's, we are a confederation. We are United States of America. And there's a resistance to sort of federalizing or nationalizing everything we do. And I think that resistance would really be felt in trying to make a national primary day.
I think a smarter thing, there is a smarter way to do this. I think a series of regional primaries. Let's take the sports teams, the Pac-10. Let's have a Big Ten primary. There's already an SEC primary. And how about an old Yankee Conference primary for New England? Or maybe a Big East primary. I mean, and I think, you know, the ACC. And that way, regional interest could be addressed. I realize that it's tough with Rhode Island. Our interest, you know, New England, we're fractured. It's not like Iowa's first. And, you know, ethanol is like the Bible. And their interests in New Hampshire always get mentioned. And the candidates have to pay attention to that. And by the time we come around here in Little Rhode Island, we care about things like the fishing economy, the environment, manufacturing loss. Those issues just don't get heard in a presidential election. So I think a series of regional primaries would be the best way to go.
Let's go to a question over here.
I want to ask a parallel question concerning the splintering of the party. I've heard that Jill Stein has been making appeals to Sanders supporters. Do you think there's any likelihood that the Sanders candidacy, it seems to me Sanders is likely to support Clinton and campaign for Clinton, but do you think his backers may be so disaffected that they move toward the Green Party? And
welcome to Bush v. Gore. Back in 2000, 25,000 people in New Hampshire voted for Ralph Nader. Al Gore lost New Hampshire by 7,000 votes. Now, without that, there is no Florida because Al Gore's at 271 if he won New Hampshire. I think the Democrats will get that message out there. Don't throw your vote away. Ms. Stein's a wonderful person, very bright, but I just don't see a lot of traction there.
Ralph Nader got 98,000 votes in Florida. So, but Al Gore lost his home state, and that was nobody's fault but Al Gore's. So, and I also want to say this gentleman here says Bernie Sanders hasn't lost the nomination yet. You're absolutely right. So we don't want to presume that Clinton is the nominee. But I think Sanders will have to be given a prominent role. And I'm not sure about the Green Party, but the Green Party in contested states where it's close could cost the Democrats the victory in those states. So you have to think about that, weighing your value of the independent party versus what you think a Democratic president might accomplish.
Let's go to one more question.
The president makes, he has a lot of power, but the Congress and the Senate governs the country. This election, do you see because of the Republicans stonewalling and we're not going to vote, we're not going to move on this, and just stalling the government for the last almost two solid years, do you think there's going to be a backlash in the Senate and the Congress to break that?
The Senate maybe yes, the House no.
Scott, hang on a second. The question over perception of Republican stonewalling might create a backlash that would help Democrats to regain the Senate.
It's an excellent question. I want to correct the record a little bit because in the fall, last fall, when John Boehner stepped down, one of the reasons he stepped down, I think, for a lot of reasons, conservatives didn't like him, obviously. He was tired, but he also was worried about the fate of the Republican Party and the House. So in stepping down, Paul Ryan only agreed to be Speaker if they would pass the debt ceiling in the budget and fund the appropriations bill before he took over as Speaker. It was the trade he made. And then they passed infrastructure, they passed elementary and secondary reauthorization, they passed a modest tax bill. They passed more legislation in 6 weeks in the House and the Senate, controlled by Republicans, than they had the prior year and a half. So it's not as if they can't make Congress work. It's that now it appears that they won't. That's a big difference, I think. And also, every time Congress doesn't do anything, the president issues executive orders. The presidency has become more powerful, despite any sort of perception you might imagine, under George W. Bush with the security regime, and then Barack Obama with domestic policy, than we have seen in since FDR. So it's a very powerful institution. We should worry about that. We want Congress to be a bigger player in the federal government.
Agree.
Brandon, do you want to make an added comment on that question?
Yeah, I mean, we have three co-equal branches of government. And at the end of the day, the president should not be legislating from the White House, from the Oval Office. And he's been governing by executive order. And that's really scary. So it's encouraging that under Paul Ryan as Speaker, we've made some progress, as Professor Schiller mentioned.
Congress has to step up. Republicans actually have to do things. If they don't want the president to do this, you'll agree, just as they did last fall, they have to step up and start doing their job.
There'll be a Republican president, so.
Thank you. You've been a great audience. Thank you so much for coming out.